Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Hey guys, welcome to Breaking Banks, this first week of October 2019. I am your host, Brett King, and Breaking Banks is the number one fintech podcast and radio show globally, going out to over 6.5 million listeners in 180 countries around the world. Busy conference season coming up. We just had Finovate and Sibos last week. We're going to get into more events coming up shortly. But before we get into the interviews today, we have Dara Talkowski talking about her new podcast, Tech on Reg. And then we're going to be hearing from Dr. Englem Goh, who is the CTO of HP Enterprise's artificial intelligence team. Really super interesting interview that I totally geeked out on. But before we get to that, let's cover off some of the hot news in the fintech space going on right now. If you've been watching, PayPal got their Chinese payments license. It was announced this week. They're the first foreign firm to get an online payments license in China. This occurred in parallel with an acquisition of a 70% stake in Gaofubao, or GoPay, as it's known locally in the English vernacular. And this is a pretty big deal because, the People's Bank of China approved this acquisition, and this is closing as we speak. But this means that PayPal becomes the first foreign company to enter the Chinese market. This is 2 years after Beijing promised to open it up to competition. But of course, Visa and MasterCard have still not had their license applications approved. And so PayPal now is getting to take on market giants WeChat Pay and Alipay in their own backyard. In other news related to this, Revolut has announced a big move and a partnership with a new global deal with Visa. This gives them access to 24 new markets, bringing to a total of 56 markets globally, where Revolut will be doing card issuance. And obviously, this is part of their growth. We've seen them in Europe. We've seen them launch an outpost in Australia. But now we hear talk about North America, Singapore, Japan, amongst other countries. Nikolai Storonsky, the CEO and founder of Revolut, he told Reuters that right now they have about 1,500 people supporting this effort, but they're going to have to ramp up by next summer. They plan to be around 5,000 people in the Revolut team. So this is pretty impressive growth that we see happening over at Revolut. Rapid, R-A-P-Y-D, that is, a fintech as a service platform, raised $100 million. That was announced this week. We see NAB and Westpac have invested in the open banking startup Basiq. That's B-A-S-I-Q. And so that's the size of the deal was not disclosed, but it's good to see some of the Aussie banks taking a defensive position with fintech. But Deutsche Bank back in the news this week with branch closures. So within Germany, the number of bank branches has declined pretty sharply from 40,000 bank branches in 2007 to 28,000 in 2018. We've seen this happening in the US. We've seen it happening in the UK. But Deutsche Bank, of course, is in the wars lately as a result of their continuing efforts to restructure their cost base, particularly around their retail operation. We also see Spain's Bnext, which has announced they have secured $25 million in Series A funding to launch in Latin America. Lots of good fintech stuff happening. Now, last week on the show, you recall we had Liz Lumley on, and she talked about the conference coming up in London, 11th to 13th of November, at Printworks in London. It's the Fintech Talents Festival. They bill it as the ultimate global fintech festival. They really have focused a lot more on sort of a total event. There's craft beers and music and stuff like that. I guess trying to be a little bit more like the South by Southwest of fintech. So they have over 400 different financial service institutions at the event. Some of the speakers that are going to be there: Ann Bowden, CEO of Starling Bank; Josh Bottomley, who heads up digital globally for HSBC; Paul Navarro, good friend of ours, Chief Digital Officer at TSB; Andrew Smith, the CTO of ClearBank. We ran into him briefly at Cybos last week, and you know, a bunch of others. So check that out. But of course, the big event that's coming up in the US in a couple of weeks is Money 2020 out of Vegas, October 27 to 30. And this is one of the biggest conferences in the US for fintech. Dan Schulman will be there talking about PayPal's operations. Valentin Stahl from N26, CEO and co-founder there, no doubt talking about their US plans and what they have planned for their US expansion. And Charles Schwab from Schwab.com will be there, along with Yelena McWilliams, the FDIC chairman, and others. So that's definitely worth checking out. But I will also be there, and we are partnering with Clickatel, a team based out of Cape Town working on chat tech. And we are going to have a special invitation for you guys, for Breaking Banks listeners. So I asked Peter from Clickatel to come on the show and tell us about the plans for Money 2020 Vegas. One of our partners for Money 2020 coming up in a couple of weeks is Clickatel. And so I've invited Peter Alon from Clickatel to talk about this event we're collaborating on out at Money 2020. Peter, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thank you, Brett. Appreciate having the time.
Now, where are you joining us from right now?
Right now, I'm in Cape Town, South Africa.
Great. And so you're coming to Vegas up in a couple of weeks. Tell us about this this Clickatel event that you've got, this networking event you've got happening at Las Vegas, coinciding with Money 2020.
Yeah, Brett, we've got many influencers from the industry, ranging from Visa to MasterCard to many banks and VCs, joining us for a conversation on how chat commerce is changing the landscape of engagement. And you're a big you know, author and proponent in terms of how do we reimagine banking. And I think this ties well with a new paradigm shift on consumer engagement.
Absolutely. Well, you know, chat's become important, you know, as a precursor to stuff that we're doing with voice in a few years. We see the early sprouts for that. But clearly, you know, chat has become a more popular vehicle for customers getting support and so forth. So when and where is this event, Peter? What's the format?
Yeah, it's going to be on Monday afternoon at 4 o'clock, right at that time, more or less, when we get tired of, you know, the talks and walking the hallways. So a little bit of a reprieve for conference goers. We'll get them into a nice venue, which is the Smith & Wolinski restaurant.
Oh, nice.
The Venetian, which is right by the conference.
They make and great steaks there, right?
Engaging conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Very cool. So just to confirm, the date is the 28th of October?
That's correct. And from 4 p.m. till 6.
4 p.m. till 6. That's the Clickatel Influencer Program, Smith & Wolinski Steakhouse, which is at the Grand Canal Shops at the Venetian Resort. If you don't know where the Grand Canal Shops are, it's obviously where the Venetian-style waterways are in the Venetian complex. So, Peter, thanks for joining us, and we will be sure to tweet out a link for registration, or if you're interested in that event, tweet us out, let us know. And, Peter, how do people get in touch with you at Clickatel in case they want to follow up directly?
Yeah, absolutely. They can reach us either through our website or my direct email or via LinkedIn. It's peter.devilliers@clickatel.com.
All right. On LinkedIn, they can find you. And do you guys use Twitter?
We do.
What's your Twitter ID?
The handle is Clickatel.
Great. Thanks for joining us, Peter.
Thank you, Brett. Keep well.
So as you guys know, we have been currently looking at a couple of different podcasts that we've been launching. We're launching another one this week, which we're very pleased and very happy about. And so I'm inviting to to join us on the show today to talk about that, Dara Tarkowski. I hope I pronounced that correctly, Dara.
You did great. Thanks, Brett.
And so you're launching with us the Tech on Reg podcast and kicking off with some guests that we may know and some others that we're going to get to know. But let's first of all start with a little bit about you to introduce you to the Breaking Banks audience. I know you've been on a couple of shows with Jason and, you know, you've been a big supporter of Breaking Banks over the months. But tell me a bit about yourself and what you do at Acute Law, the firm that you work at.
Sure. So I'm one of the founders of Actuate Law in Chicago, Illinois. And we launched Actuate in 2018 after my partners and I spent, you know, a decade plus at two very large Am Law 100 law firms. And we started the firm primarily because we wanted to do more interesting and exciting things with startups and technology. And they were things that I think were maybe a little too risky or not palatable to the, you know, to mainstream big law firms. So we wanted to take some risks and, you know, we did that in 2018. In 2019, we launched our RegTech subsidiary, but, you know, we're all practicing lawyers who like to do cool stuff with cool people and cool clients.
Now, obviously, you do a ton of work in the fintech space. You advise players in the space with a focus on reform of regulation and supervision and so forth. But I think, you know, you want to take a broader view of how technology is changing regulation in general, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think what I've observed in practice over the years, particularly as it's pertained to financial services, but we've really seen it play out with many clients that the firm has in lots of different regulated areas, that it's, you know, same noodle, different sauce. It's a different kind, different sets of regulations, but lots of businesses who are trying to innovate, regardless of kind of what lane they fall in, are trying to do so within the rules, within regulations, and are just really searching for more cost-effective, compliant solutions and, you know, how to do it the right way without getting in trouble with the regulators. And I think conceptually, the way industry is moving, it's pretty industry agnostic. We certainly see that play out very, very clearly in financial services across the world. But it's not isolated to that. I think founders everywhere, regardless of kind of the lanes that they're playing in, are feeling the same types of pain points from their respective regulators. So the podcast is going to kind of tackle all of it, which I'm really excited about.
So let's talk conceptually about how regulation might change. You know, the one, you know, a couple of the examples I like to use is, for example, you know, anti-money laundering legislation that we have. There's a huge amount of effort globally that gets put into tracking money laundering and trying to prevent it. But in reality, we're actually really spectacularly poor at preventing money laundering. And so that's probably a good candidate for something like the use of artificial intelligence to track money flows, identify suspicious actors, and sort of stop them from using the financial networks around the world. But we're talking about a pretty big leap in capabilities for regulators there, right?
Yes, unfortunately, I think based on my observations in practice, so much of the regulation we see once it's actually put into practice is much more form over substance. They want compliance systems to look a certain way. They want to check boxes. They want things that are easily auditable from a regulatory perspective, you know, without a lot of regard for what may or may not be terribly effective, which to me seems a little bit backwards if the regulator's job is to be protecting us all. But that's not really for me to say, just
sure.
An observation.
You're just you're there to implement. So here's a question. If you know, we're going to be increasingly using data and we've got machine learning and technologies like that, The current role of regulators around the world in most industries tends to be quite supervisory based, where they're coming in and checking on whether you comply with the various policies or legislation that's in play. But that's a very human-led process. Do you think those humans are at risk of automation?
I don't think the regulators are at risk of being replaced by automation, although they could certainly benefit from, you know, the use of the technology to make their own work more efficient. But I don't see the humans behind those processes going anywhere, because at the end of the day, those are political roles. At least they certainly can be here in the United States. Yeah. I don't want to speak for other jurisdictions. So I don't see those individuals going anywhere. Typically, they're appointed positions. They take up large swaths of government budgets, and they're
so pretty sticky.
I think it's a very sticky system. But I will say that there are certain regulators and certain offices that you can tell are kind of inching their way towards accepting the fact that, you know, innovation is happening. The CFPB here in the United States, they have an innovation office. How effective it is remains to be seen. But, you know, politics continues to play a role in everything that agency does.
Yeah.
And that's not changing anytime soon.
Yeah.
Certainly not with the 2020 election coming up.
Yeah.
But at least optically, efforts are being made, but the wheels of justice and the law move terribly, terribly slowly. So I think that industry, on the flip side, are going to be the ones that, once they start implementing the tools, and if there's wide acceptance of these sorts of more reg tech compliance, technology driven tools by industry, the regulators are going to have to learn it. They're going to have to catch up. At least that should be the goal. And when a human regulator has to start auditing, a machine learning compliance tool, I think that's where the rubber will meet the road. And then all of a sudden the government is going to be like, oh, maybe we should implement some tools for ourselves.
Yeah. So probably one of the most, it's ironic that you're just heading to London, because, you know, one of the more progressive regulators appears to be the FCA in the UK. They've been running these tech sprints.
I would certainly agree with that.
Right. Part of what they've tried to do is put regulation in a code base, and then look at, you know, part of their hackathon sort of tech sprint exercises have been around what might happen is if regulation was in a code base and that regulation changed, how would that be implemented, in a working, ecosystem. And so as we start to try and encode regulation in a code base, and look at that structure, how might that change the relationship between legislation and policy formation and the way we implement, those sort of compliance rules?
Well, if it works, then I think obviously there's a lot less friction in that process. For me, when you look at the different regulators and the authority that each of those regulators have, you know, some of them have the ability to pass rules, regulations, but when we're talking about more material legislative changes, that comes from a different, right, that comes from a different place, and it's implemented in a different way. And then which regulators ultimately have the authority to do what is always the question. There's a lot of overlap in the U.S. between the states, the feds, and even several federal regulators for one entity. So where I think the most interesting implementation of that will be how the different regulators talk to each other. Because we might have a situation where one agency is much more sophisticated than another. But just by way of example, in the US, depending on what kind of financial institution you are, you might have the CFPB who supervises one part of your business, the OCC that supervises another, and then the FTC who gets to come in and make the rules if you do something stupid. So,
and then the state banking regulator and the payments regulator, right?
100%. But I didn't want to list all 51 of them. So I kept it at the federal level, but you're absolutely right. So if one of those agencies implements something elegant and sophisticated, query whether or not the other regulators will be able to take advantage of it. And so to me, I think that kind of, because of the fragmented regulatory system that many jurisdictions have, that's where I think there's really room for innovation.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting because it speaks to the fact that as technology forces the regulatory environment to modernize and implement these tools, they may themselves be forced to really re-examine their structure, right? Particularly the fragmented nature.
Yes, I think that industry participants in the U.S. have been desperately wanting the United States regulatory structure re-examined for a very long time for all sorts of reasons.
Yeah.
And if technology is going to be the thing that actually pushes, the state and federal governments to either work more symbiotically or there's a reevaluation of who regulates who, that would be fantastic, right? Yeah, if it prompts a conversation, there's nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely. Let's not even get into the CRA and reform of that, but that's a bugbear of mine. Okay. You talk a lot about fintech. Obviously, we're discussing that, and that's a big focus we've had on Breaking Banks over the years. Of course, I worked with Joanne Barefoot on my book, Bank Forward, where we had a chapter on RegTech, and Henry Aslanian's been on the show as well. But tell us a little bit more about the guests that you're going to focus on in Tech on Reg.
Sure. So we've made a really concerted effort to kind of expand a little bit beyond financial services, because the observations that we've had is that all of the pain points in regulation, automation, and the digitizing of financial services are very, very similar to the narratives we hear in lots of other highly regulated industries and the pain points that they're dealing with their respective regulators. So we're going to be examining the law in general and legal innovation. We're going to be talking about cannabis. We're going to be talking about healthcare. We're going to have an episode or two on sex tech. I know that's very exciting for a lot of people, but there's lots of interesting things happening there from a regulatory perspective. So it's really going to run the gamut. And we've got some really interesting people and thought leaders from really a wide spectrum of highly regulated industry.
Now, those of us that work in financial services or fintech, we often talk about the fact that financial services is one of the more heavily regulated industries. But, where does it stack up against other industries in terms of regulation?
I mean, if you talk about an industry like healthcare in the United States, certainly, food safety, no doubt in my mind or in anybody else's mind that financial services is one of the more heavily regulated industries, but it isn't necessarily more heavily regulated than the healthcare space. And then you talk about, physicians trying to do innovative things with telemedicine and trying to provide patients better care vis-a-vis the use of technology. Healthcare is talking about people's lives. Financial services is talking about people's lives and livelihoods. There's lots of interesting analogies to be drawn. But you guys, we're up there. Don't get me wrong. But there's lots of other people that could, industry that can give financial services a run for their money too.
Yeah, no. So I think that's pretty clear, particularly as you see organizations like Apple and others working on medical devices that could change the way diagnosis is made, or artificial intelligence being involved in, the diagnostics work, examining x-rays, blood work, et cetera, like that. There is a need in all of these industries to get a fresh update. So tell me what inspired you to go down the podcast path.
So I'm raising my hand and saying I'm a super nerd. I've been listening to podcasts in all shapes and sizes for several years. And it's something that I personally really enjoy. And I started listening to your podcast. And I thought that there was kind of an interesting space for the stuff that I wanted to talk about. And I'm a lawyer, like I'm a trial lawyer by nature. I'm a chatty gal. Like that's just the truth. And I love having these conversations with people all the time. And it's so funny because Jason Henricks and I find ourselves in the middle of all of these kind of interesting, you know, debates on various subjects at any point in time when we're working together on whatever we're working together on. And every once in a while, he would just stop me and say, Dara, that's a podcast. That's an episode.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And I had never really thought about it. And I said, you know what, Jason, I think you're right. And let's give it a shot.
So let's drill down on that a little bit. The trial lawyer thing is, you know, do you think it takes a particular type of personality to be a good trial lawyer?
So certainly there are personality traits that I think are common to the trial bar. It's not a place for wallflowers. You certainly have to be comfortable standing in front of a room. But truth be told, I think that the best trial lawyers are storytellers.
Yeah.
And
it's a common theme there.
I mean, I think so. You've got to convince, you know, it's one thing to be an excellent legal writer and convince someone with your writing. And I think it's quite different to stand up in front of a jury.
Because they may be novice, so you have to explain to them where the law fits in terms of the argument, and then build a story to support the legal position, but in a way that people can understand it. So communication skills are essential.
Yeah, communication skills are essential. Being personable is essential. Being able to tell a story, and then also it's about trust building. Jurors aren't going to vote for your client if they don't trust, right? So right at the beginning from opening statements, from the time you're selecting your jury, it is about building trust with the people who are ultimately going to decide the fates of your client. So it's a lot of soft skills. I would call it a lot. It's a very soft skill heavy profession. And that's how I got my start. I'm a trained trial lawyer, member of the trial bar.
I'm fascinated by that. I've always wondered what it would be like to stand up in front of a court. I guess it's not so different from what I do when I do keynotes and stuff like that. But the application of the technical aspects of it, being able to find the right legal precedent or legal thing on the side. Obviously, some of that is research, but some of it's also just being able to connect the dots in real time as it's happening, right?
Yeah. So it's a lot of thinking on your feet. You know, I do a lot of public speaking as well, and I'd say the one major difference I feel between when I'm in front of the bench or in front of a jury trying a case versus when I'm on stage giving a presentation or a keynote is your client is literally sitting right behind you at the table, very acutely listening to your every word.
Yes.
And they are paying you by the hour, and they really want to make sure that you're not screwing up.
And they could have a lot at stake.
certainly, you know, people's liberties, people's, you know, financial futures, lots and lots at stake in some of the matters that I handle for individuals and for businesses too. You know, businesses, they have, you know, bet the company cases, and that's not an exaggeration. Sometimes if a case doesn't go well, you have bet the company and the company doesn't exist anymore. So, you know, we take those responsibilities. I take those responsibilities really seriously. But there is a different level of anxiety that happens when the person who's hired you and trusted you and put all of that faith in you is literally sitting right behind you, listening to every word.
So tell us about the first few guests that you've got lined up for the show.
Oh, absolutely. So I am ecstatic to be able to premiere the podcast with, honestly, a friend and mentor, Gela Boscovich. And the first subject we're tackling hits a few of my favorites. We're talking about technology and diversity and just generally algorithmic bias in AI as it pertains to financial services. But Gela is fantastic. Anyone who's listened to, you know, your show or who's been to the FinTech conference circuit obviously knows her well.
She's been on the show multiple times with us. She's great. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're you know, kind of tackling the subject from a little bit more of a regulatory viewpoint. So I'm absolutely thrilled to be, you know, debuting the podcast with her. We've got Professor Daniel Linna from Northwestern University Law School's Legal Innovation Lab, who's recently just launched an initiative with Northwestern University's Computer Science PhD department. So the law school and the PhD computer science students are going to be launching a lab to essentially create legal innovative products to solve legal problems. And a lot of it is focused on finding products to kind of serve the underserved legal community, you know, little to no income, and trying to find technology solutions to solve those everyday legal problems for people who wouldn't otherwise have access to lawyers. So we're talking about kind of legal innovation and what they're doing over at Northwestern. We've got some really interesting founders in a few different spaces. Lots of interesting stuff to come.
Very cool. Well, thank you, Dara, for putting your faith in Provoke Media and working with us at Breaking Banks to get your podcast out. I know it's going to be huge because there is a big gap in the market on this RegTech side, and I think it's really exciting, and we look forward to seeing it unfold.
Awesome. I look forward to continuing to work with you guys, and thank you so much.
Awesome. All right, guys. So while we're in London last week at Cybos, we sat down with the Hewlett-Packard Enterprise Division and the CTO of HPE's Artificial Intelligence and HPC practice, Dr. Engineer Lim Go, and he is going to be joining us next, talking about artificial intelligence, machine learning, and when we might expect to see machines that can replicate human intelligence or artificial general intelligence. That's coming up right now. Hey guys, you know, my life runs on my smartphone, my mobile phone, getting access to emails, messaging, you know, messaging systems, social media, all this sort of stuff. I'm using this every day. But if you're on mobile every day, like I am, and if you're still using one of the big wireless providers here in the United States in 2019, you need to ask yourself, what exactly are you paying for? Between the expensive retail stores, the inflated prices, the hidden fees, you're being taken advantage of because these guys know you have no choice but to pay. But now you do. Enter Mint Mobile. Mint Mobile provides the same premium network coverage, premium data coverage that you're used to with the big guys, but at a fraction of the cost because everything they do is online. Mint Mobile saves on retail locations and overhead, then passes those savings directly on to their customers. For me, what makes a difference in Mint Mobile's plan is instead of paying a premium for unlimited data you'll never use, you can choose your own data plans. You can choose between 3 gigs a month, 8 or 12 gigabytes of data a month across their 4G LTE networks. And for me, it's all about the data, folks. That's what really drives me. But get this. Mint Mobile just charges you $15 a month, unlimited nationwide talk and text, and you choose the data package you want, $15 a month. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan. You keep your same phone number. Obviously, you keep your contacts. You ditch your old wireless bill. Start saving with Mint Mobile. So to get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month and get the plan shipped straight to your door for free, go to mintmobile.com/fintech. That's mintmobile.com/fintech and cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/fintech. This week's podcast is also brought to you by our friends at privacy.com. Privacy.com lets you buy things online using virtual credit and debit cards instead of your real ones, protecting your identity, your bank information on the internet in real time. Now, you guys, I don't know about you, but I'm doing everything online these days. If I'm not on Amazon, you know, shopping, I'm using Uber Eats or Seamless here in New York to order my food or dinner for Katie and I. You know, we're getting school supplies for Charlie, our 7-year-old daughter. You know, we do all this stuff online. And so having that additional protection of this product that really protects you online is absolutely key. So anytime we're online these days, we give access to our personal information. We're giving this to merchants, to data partners. This exchange of information isn't always secure, as we hear about these breaches all the time. So privacy.com allows you to pay and transfer money online using a one-time use virtual card number instead of your real credit or debit card information. So you don't have to worry about forgetting to cancel subscriptions or trials, because if they try and rebill a single-use card, it's not going to work. You can set spending limits for yourself, linked into budgeting. You never have to worry about changing your card if it gets hacked, because privacy.com cards are locked to a specific merchant, and you get an instant notification if a hacker tries to use that card somewhere else. So the benefits of privacy.com: you get that security online, you get to take control of your finances and set your delivery around specific merchants to specific budgets, you can control your subscriptions and recurring payments, you can link it into your browser if you're using Chrome, for example, just one click. It's all really, really simple. So I really strongly, being in the fintech space and knowing the threat that identity theft has in the space, I really suggest you check out privacy.com. Head to privacy.com/fintech. That's privacy.com/fintech, FINTECH, to sign up and start shopping. As a special treat for Breaking Banks listeners, new customers will automatically get $5 to spend on your first purchase. Yep, that's free money just to use on any online purchase. Go to privacy.com/fintech and sign up now.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
We are here with engineer Dr. Go, who's also the CTO of HP Enterprise's Artificial Intelligence Division.
Thank you.
Is that correct?
That's precisely. Thank you, Brett.
Now, when we look at the field of AI, some really exciting things have been happening in recent times. Of course, when we talk about artificial intelligence, most people will sort of think of robots taking over the world and things like this. But actually, the really interesting advances appear to have happened just in the last few years.
Yes.
Suddenly, there seems to be a lot of progress, a lot of investment. So why is that, Dr. Go? Yeah. What has happened, yeah, to change that sort of tempo around that?
First, we talk about what we think artificial intelligence means, right?
Right.
At least in today's context. To most people, it means not just a smart system. Not just a smart system because you programmed it to be smart, to follow rules that human gave it. But also it means that it can learn on its own.
Right. So this is the big difference, the machine learning element.
That's right.
Because in the past we had like expert systems where we tried to encode human behavior. Right?
Correct. And we extract the human experience, take humans' expertise and encode them and put them in the machine based on rules. But now there is this additional thing, right, where you give the machine the ability to learn from the data you feed it with. So machine learning to be artificially intelligent.
Right.
That's how I phrase it.
Yes.
Right. Now, given this, right, why more recently? Well, the techniques of machine learning have been available for decades, right? What was the difference is that more recently, availability of data, right? Access to that data more easily.
Yes.
Because you need huge volumes for the machine to learn through a trial and error process until it eventually becomes good, right?
Right.
Right, at prediction. Therefore, lots of data. More recently, access to it is easier.
Yes.
Internet, right? Volumes of data have been accumulated to a threshold extent, right? And also compute power cheap enough, right? to be able to plow through all that data. So therefore, more recently, you see this re-emergence of AI.
So with this sort of backward propagation process and so forth, you're talking
about that.
A little bit. And Rosenblatt perceptrons and all of these
impressive
things, a student of, but a novice certainly compared with yourself. But the real advancement has been pattern recognition, right? Is machines, because learning is not all of it. It's the ability to, say, recognize differences. And so how does a machine, for example, how does a machine recognize the difference between a dog and a cat in a machine learning sense?
Well, in image recognition, there are different ways you implement these machine learning techniques. One way is to feed it lots of examples, pictures of cats and pictures without cats in them.
Right.
But first you need to label them.
Right.
This picture has a cat in it, this in different ways, hidden behind bushes, upside down and all, right? Big and small. And these pictures have other things in it, but without cats. So you train it, right?
I see.
And eventually it recognizes what a cat is. And it also additionally with by looking at details. First, it starts with very fine details, like hair of certain kind, and then hair that somehow go in a certain shape that forms a cat's eye, right? That's different from a dog's eye, and then going outward from there.
Right.
Yeah. But it does this effectively only because you have sufficient data that are labeled well.
Right. So that's the big difference right now, is the availability of data, the mass of data.
And labeled.
Yes, and labeling.
In fact, a few years ago, we had lots of data, internet, lots of pictures, right? But we didn't have them labeled. So many of these internet companies actually, they don't talk about that much. They hire lots of people to label them.
Yes.
There's a lot of manual labeling going on,
yes,
right, in order to feed the machine in a supervised way.
Right, but of course that will be automated too at some point. Right?
Once you can recognize cats, right, then you use that to label.
Now you've been at this for some time, obviously. You're a veteran in the industry. I don't want to make you sound old, but I want to make you sound experienced.
I'm old.
as are we all.
Yeah.
Now, tell me a little bit about your background, because you were at Silicon Graphics before this. You joined HP in the last 3 years or so, I understand. But tell me about your career as an engineer and how you got to being in the AI space.
Oh, well, I'm glad you ask. I'm only 3 years with HPE. But before that, I was 27 years with Silicon Graphics.
Yes.
And about half of it as CTO for Silicon Graphics. And then 3 years ago, HP acquired
the Silicon Graphics.
Silicon Graphics, and I came with it.
Yeah. Good.
All right.
Package deal.
Yes. And there's one thing about this acquisition that is very positive for many of the employees from Silicon Graphics is that, for example, myself, one day I got a note from HPE, right, saying, congratulations, this is your anniversary. So when I looked at the badge, right, I have the badge with me here.
Oh, yeah.
When I looked at the badge and I thought, you know, why does it say 30 years?
Yes.
It should be 3.
Yeah.
So HPE counted the 27.
Oh, that's nice.
Yes,
that's nice of them.
Yeah. So they by 30 years. Anyway, I started 27 years ago at Silicon Graphics, focusing on graphics. That has some relationship with many of the image recognition machine learning tools. You see GPU companies moving from graphics to AI. Actually,
like NVIDIA's AI chips and so forth.
Yes, similarly. So Silicon Graphics was pre-NVIDIA, right?
Yes, of course.
Right. And then in the year 96, we started to build analytics solutions that leverages the fact that these GPUs can deal with data well also. And that was where, in 96, we started in this path from analytics towards machine learning. Yeah, so it was that long ago.
Now you started, but you didn't start in AI, you started in mechanical engineering?
Yes,
right?
My first degree was mechanical engineering. Then I got a job with Schlumberger after being interviewed in Edinburgh.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Birmingham University, went to Edinburgh, interviewed, and was sent to the North Sea to log oil wells carrying two PDP-11s.
Wow.
Yeah, that was my first job.
PDP-11.
Yeah, those were days. Yeah.
So the most famous use of a PDP-11, I think, is for the Voyager spacecraft. That's how they did the the code for that. So I went down to the it's in San Francisco, right? The JPL labs. I went down there years ago.
JPL labs,
south of the area. Mm-hmm. And I went down there, and they said, yeah, we turn it on like once a week or whatever at this time. This was like a decade ago. And we get the signal from, we have to do the deep space network to get the signal from Voyager.
Yes, they bounced it off a geosynchronous satellite.
Exactly. Yeah. So this was before it left the heliosphere and so forth. But the PDP-11 was kept up to date. I don't know if they've shifted it off there now, and they've probably modernized the code.
Tell you a story related to that, right? So NASA is a 30-year customer of SGI and HPE. We recently work on something which we believe will help them with their space exploration, because a lot of their hardware, necessarily so, is hardened in the hardware sense, so that it will definitely work for mission critical thing. But I was thinking, if we could launch the very latest, because those hardened ones are more than a decade old, right? Can you launch the very latest and will it work? So I wrote a one pager to NASA. They accepted it. We launched it in 2017. We put the very latest at that time Broadwell processors on the space station. It worked for 1.6 years here.
Okay.
And it has since returned to Earth after going through the harsh re-entry. Yeah. We tested it in our lab. When it came back, it still worked.
Yeah. Right.
So NASA is now very keen about also carrying these high-performance computers with them, the very latest one at launch, unhardened, but hardened by software. I call it hardening by software, a bit of a contradictory in terms of...
Okay, so how does that work?
Yeah, we loaded smart software in it, rules-based for now, but eventually going towards machine learning. First phase is rules-based. The machine will look at its situation, right? If it is doing a lot of having a lot of correctable errors, to maybe slow itself down.
I see.
Hopefully that those correctable does not go beyond a threshold that becomes uncorrectable, right? Things like that, yeah. And to tell the astronaut, I'm sorry, I may have to stop now, because if I carry on, I might break. The whole idea is to be able to do a 3-year journey to Mars and back.
Right. So this is, I guess, a difference in sort of neural net tech, because, with persistent memory in computers, we could have partial failure of a memory chip and it still works, but a CPU, you lose 10,000 transistors and
you're done,
right?
Yeah. So in the 1.6 years, we harshly tested and drove the computer, running three sets of benchmark, including the fourth one, which was to keep writing and reading the disk.
Yes.
They were SSDs. The CPU did not fail.
That's great.
Right. There were a number of level 3 cache errors that were correctable. That's fine. No significant memory errors that could be a concern, right? The only issue were 9 of our 20 SSDs failed.
Yeah,
but those were fine. They were made redundant, but we learned something from it.
Yeah, because we know we know from the experiences of the astronauts on the space station, like Scott Kelly, who was up there for almost a year, and they talk about having the
twins, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The twin study they did, and he talks about the fact that his vision, he'll see. It's not neutrinos. What is the particles they have in space? Cosmic particles
that shoot through.
If you can visually see a cosmic particle that shoots through your vision, passing through your optic nerve, then it's going to be affecting the chips, right?
Yes. Yeah. Modern computers, one of the learnings from this experiment we did for NASA is that modern computers are pretty sturdy, with a lot of error correction capability built in. Memory, when you buy a DIMM, right? DRAM memory, they have lots of redundancies in there, right? And they stood up. So this was a great learning. NASA liked it, liked the learning enough that they awarded us the Exceptional Technology Achievement, a medal.
Yes.
We just received a medal at NASA Houston recently.
So maybe you'll have to go to the space station, test some of this stuff out yourself.
There we go. that was the point. We needed to put smarts in there because the idea was we can't expect the astronauts to be IT savvy to maintain the computer. Therefore, to make it maintain itself.
Yeah.
So
that's great.
Yeah. Although I had a lot of volunteers from engineers who fly up there. I'll fix it.
Engineers,
yeah, you can pull
program.
The smarts out. Yeah. I'll fly.
There's not many engineers that don't think space is cool.
So. Yeah.
Now, HP Enterprise, tell us about now the team you have working on artificial intelligence around the globe.
We have a team probably, if you add all the different groups up, right, across the company, 100, 150 people that understands it, can develop code, or implement solutions for customers. Yeah, we don't call all of them data scientists, right? Some are data engineers that are great at looking at, because that's 80% of the job a lot of times in projects, amassing the data, normalizing them in the right way, deal with the gaps, right?
Yes.
Handle the biases, but that's that requires some social aspects to come in also. So yes, if you group all the whole team together that can work on a delivery to a customer, either a proof of concept or production, we're talking about 100, 150 people. So it's a strong group.
Yeah.
And in the last 2.5-3 years, we probably have done about 100 use cases. All the way from, of course, the space station to finance, to retail, a lot of retail examples, all the way to medicine. Yeah, the medicine one was profound, right? The one that sticks in my mind.
The diagnostic stuff, the potential is huge.
This example, right? I mean, you know, we were called to a hospital in a city with lots of cases of tuberculosis. City decided to x-ray everybody above a certain age. They can x-ray fast. But the problem was the diagnosis of those images by the doctors, backlog of 2 weeks. Problem is, if someone is already infected, they go out infecting for 2 more weeks before being called in.
Yeah?
Because it takes 2 weeks backlog.
Incubation.
So, yeah. So what we did, we went in there, took all the old images that were labeled by the doctors, with TB, without TB, trained the neural network, plug it to the x-ray machine. After an x-ray, within 1 second, the machine says you are okay. Oh, by the way, you still have to wait 2 weeks for the doctor to certify you okay.
Right.
But at least but so far, I've not been wrong. Right?
Wow. How many of those x-rays or images did you need to pass through to get that accurate result?
We only could get tens of thousands of images, not enough. But it was good enough to get to this point.
Yes.
Typically, we would want, you know, well-labeled, good quality images. 100,000 would be a good start. Yeah. We didn't have that many, all right, at this hospital. But it was enough to achieve the goal. The key point was that if the machine says that person is positive, doctors rush in. Not no more 2 weeks, right?
Yeah.
So that was the key.
That's the game changer.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, we often simplify AI, and we talk about three levels of artificial intelligence development. So we're in this machine learning phase now. We talk about AGI, right? And then, you know, super intelligence, AI.
Sentience, consciousness, and self-aware.
Between now and artificial general intelligence, what do you think some of the milestones in AI will be?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? I think, to be general, today, artificial neural networks are very specific. Mm. They're monolithic, and they have an objective. They have to predict, and you train it with the data specific
for that specific thing. So you got a machine learning an algorithm that can do tuberculosis. Mm. It's not going to be able to drive a Tesla motor vehicle, right?
Yes, or even MRI for a CT scan, right? Techniques have been brought up today to do transfer learning, where you don't start from scratch. If it was MRI, you can start with what you already have and do transfer learning to adjust it to learn MRI faster.
Yes.
Right, not from scratch. But even then, these are very specific. The ones we did was x-ray only, not MRI, chest only, not any other area, TB only.
Right.
And for that, fewer images, you can get good precision.
Right.
So currently, good production, sturdy applications in AI that came from ML, machine learning, are very, very specific. Right,
but to get to an algorithm where you can just take a general x-ray and diagnose a condition from that x-ray.
Yes, requires different paths to get there.
Right.
You can train a general network that may require a lot more images and the type of neural networks have to be adjusted. Or you can link up multiple specific ones and have a meta layer above that.
Right.
to stream them. Okay. So there are different ways of approaching this, but we are still working that out, right? And is there an incentive? That's the thing. The current incentive in the production world, in the industry where it's being funded,
yes,
is to achieve a certain prediction well, right? Should trade this stock really well, trade stocks really well, and so on, right? AGI tend to be less funded. They are more in the academic world today.
Yes.
But I think in general, there is just an exploration, right?
We're still learning ourselves about machine learning. Right?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. We humans are still learning ourselves, right? And then to get from AGI, where perhaps you link up multiple of these together, and if you increase it enough, the biggest neural network today is still a million times less complex than human brain.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, one connection is a weight in the neural network. Our connection, a synapse, is about 20 equations to model. We learned that from the Blue Brain Project.
Yes.
Lot more complex, right? If you link them up, will there be an emergent property?
Right.
Right. Phil Anderson, Nobel laureate, wrote a paper. Right, and I just summarize it briefly. I don't do it justice. Basically, he says everything in physics cannot explain everything in chemistry. Everything in chemistry cannot explain everything in biology. Biology, everything cannot explain everything in physiology.
Right, the emergent property is sometimes the sum is greater than the parts.
That's the reason why we get there's a degree course for every one of these, right?
Yes.
All the way up to physiology, psychology, and social sciences. Yeah?
Yes.
Right? Right. Because they
are. It's a really interesting way of viewing the world.
Right, he viewed it that way, and it sort of got me thinking, right, if you link enough of these up, can you get an emergent property that is a different
kind
of type
of intelligence than we used to? Yeah.
Correct. So there's still a chance, right?
Yes.
But the ethical question as to whether it is a good thing or not is a separate question. But I believe there is a chance it could get there. Yeah.
So on that point, let's delve into that a little bit.
Yes.
One of the concerns we have right now is we have certain algorithms that are emerging that have learned behavior from existing human behavior set or existing data set. But we have some inherent biases in processes today. So first of all, a two-part question, and you may be able to answer together. First of all, how do we eliminate those biases? Mm. And secondly, more importantly, how do we create a sort of an ethical code base so that AI in the future will be benevolent towards humans?
Great question, right? It's something we've been dwelling on for some time, at least us practitioners, right? We feel there is a responsibility on our part, even though we're delivering the objectives, to consider this, to think about this. First and foremost, right? The ethical questions about this. Now, let me give you one example. When we were developing this poker bot to play well in poker, I mean, IBM did well in chess against humans. Google did well in
Deep
Go.
Blue, and then AlphaGo,
and then I work with. I work with Carnegie Mellon University on a poker bot to play poker well,
right,
because it has one additional lack of information, and that is you don't know the other piece, your opponent's cards, unlike chess and Go. Moreover, your opponent's constantly trying to deceive you, right?
Yes.
So when we built that...
How do you get an AI to bluff?
Yes, that's right. And actually, eventually, it bluffed really well.
Yeah.
In fact, the comment when it won the poker card tournament by the human players was that it bluffed like no human. It bluffed like an alien.
You know, that's very similar to what Lisa Dole said about the AlphaGo, because,
AlphaGo Zero.
Yeah.
AlphaGo, different from AlphaGo Zero, in that AlphaGo Zero would be more alien-like, because all it did, what it did was not learn from old games, because old game had human, non-alien characters.
Yes.
What it did was to take two machines, compete even randomly against each other, but based on the rules of Go or poker. Never mind, after 1 trillion games, right, even if it plays foolishly at the beginning, 1 trillion games later, it gets pretty good. But it would have explored space in poker or Go that no humans have touched.
I find
and
it really
would be alien-like.
Yeah, I find it really interesting that, the intelligence, the emergent intelligence would be more alien to us than human. That makes sense, right?
Yeah, because it has explored space through reinforcement learning, a different kind.
Yes.
We yes. spoke about supervised learning with labeled data. Right. This one where you
more
randomly place,
yeah.
Eventually it would have explored space no human have. And that's the reason why it wins in poker and AlphaGo yes. Zero, right? The big question is, what would it be like when it becomes intelligent in an alien way? The phrase I've used, right, is that it will be an immortal alien. Mm. And therefore, there is a chance it is benevolent.
Yes.
Right? Why? It's not worried about its own mortality.
Yeah. And part
it just
of,
backs itself right. up in the cloud, right?
Right. And part of the... when we think about robot overlords taking over the world, we are thinking what a human
yes.
that is omnipotent would do.
Correct.
Right? Whereas a machine is not necessarily going to think like a human in yes. respect to power.
And the selfishness part, which is fair to have, maybe it doesn't have yes. that, right? Because it's immortal, right?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. But it also may not care, right?
Yeah. So that's the reason why I also mentioned we measure computers by IQ today.
Right.
How smart are they? We should also include EQ.
Yes, we should.
Yeah. Yeah. So okay. That was the part of my
that's
talk
the
I
outcome.
Mentioned. Right. Yeah. So it is up to us to steer it, right?
Yes.
Yeah. But it will. You see, it depends on the machine, right? There will be a kind of machine that are trained through reinforcement learning. They will be very alien-like. And it'll be another kind that's very objective specific, trained on supervised learning, that will be very human-like because they learn from human
right,
history.
Yes.
The big question is, do we keep
how
them
does,
separate or do we bring
yeah,
them together?
Does,
okay. So these are all something that we will decide, right?
Yeah. So let me finish this off by asking you, you know, over the next 12 months, mm-hmm. 2-3 years with HP Enterprise, what would you like to achieve in respect to artificial intelligence?
Mm. So we have a large group of customers in high-performance computing that were rules-based, simulation-based all this while, and they are now looking at the machine learning approach to augment their simulation-based prediction.
Yes.
Big group. We have another huge group in the commercial world. In fact, to some extent, bigger.
Yes.
Right? The finance, the retail,
yes.
and so on, that are already very much into this area. And they are the ones that are questioning whether should they go all the way to the cloud, should they, because of privacy and certain other reasons, different cost reasons, would like a hybrid model where they have a bunch of activities learning on the cloud, but a bunch that has to stay on-prem. Or they come to us in a consumption model where we put the things on-prem, but they pay by consumption.
Right.
Right. I think this is going to be the key for HPE to set it up well.
These hybrid stacks.
Yes, this hybrid stack and the GreenLake, yeah. so that to give them the alternatives, right, as they move forward to proliferate machine learning, because it is the data that counts, yeah, in at least in supervised learning.
Actually, before we wrap this up, I've got to then ask, you know, because when you start talking about stack and you start talking about these things, obviously, we've got to also start thinking about quantum.
Yes,
right?
Yes, very much
and,
so.
And quantum states and so forth.
Yes.
So here's a question, because
yeah.
I've been working a bit with Ben Goertzel. I don't know mm-hmm. if you know him,
oh,
your
yeah,
chief
yes,
scientist
yes.
out at Hanson.
You're very well informed.
And so Ben talks about the fact that maybe quantum, you know, AI on top of quantum computing may be different from classical computing terms.
Yes.
So where are you thinking right now about where quantum fits in AI?
Currently, I'm thinking the other way around. So
right.
I full respect to that view
yes.
of
I mean, we don't
quantum
know,
on top
right?
of AI, but right? But I was thinking the alternative could be quantum below AI.
Right.
Right, so the backpropagation you mentioned.
Right.
Right, today, the reason we need...
Right, for the data process. Yeah, I
guess. Yes, to do the gradient descent.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
was the idea. Currently, we do a lot of trial and error to try and gradient descend until we get to a point where the error is low
yes.
enough, the prediction is high enough that
right.
we say
so we could reduce
happy.
Those error rates.
Right. A quantum
like
computer
quantum.
Could get to that
yeah.
Minima,
yeah.
global minima. That was
yes.
the difficult part, right? Given the landscape, when you reach a minima, do you know if it is global?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
It's very difficult. You have to do an exhaustive
yeah,
search.
Yeah, that makes
right?
sense.
Yeah, quantum
yeah, yeah.
can tell you better. Get to a global minima faster. That's
yes.
the hope. So you can learn faster.
Very good.
That's the way I'm thinking quantum computers, if they become practical, will help machine to learn faster.
Yeah. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Goh, I thank you very much for your time today. It's been wonderful. I totally geek out on this stuff.
Yeah, me too.
I enjoy it.
Yes.
And so continued success. And if people want to find out about what you guys are doing in the AI, where can they go?
Our website, hp.com. If for this show, they can connect with Jennifer Smith.
Yes. Yeah,
we'll
connect. We'll tweet out her details.
Yeah, and they can connect with her.
Fantastic. Dr. Goh, thank you very much for joining Breaking Banks today.
Thank you, Brett. Appreciate it. Yeah.
That's a wrap for Breaking Banks this week. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to go to iTunes, Stitcher, Podcaster, Google Play, Spotify, wherever it is that you download your Breaking Banks from, and leave us a 5-star review. Leave us some comments. That's how people get to hear about the show. And you can also retweet it. You can put it on Insta. If you liked a guest that we had on, or you like listening to something, let us know. And if you've got suggestions for us, we would love to hear that as well. That's what makes Breaking Banks so strong, this incredible global community of support. Everywhere I go, people come up to me at conferences and events around the world, and they say, I love listening to your podcast. Some people tell me about they're on the bike to work or jogging or, you know, on the train coming into work. They listen to the show. Let us know where you listen to us and how you listen to us. That all helps us build out the experience and understand what's important for you guys on Breaking Banks. Great to be with you this week. We will be back next Thursday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New York, with another episode of Breaking Banks. See you then.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.